Mini episode 743 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to mini episode number 743 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We have an outstanding guest with us today, one of the greatest rock drummers of all time, somebody who has lived a legendary career and who writes about it in very compelling fashion in his autobiography, Stick It, My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. Of course, you can find this book many different places, but one of the places you can order it is at his website at carmenapiece.net. I'm speaking, of course, of the one and only legendary Carmine Appice. We welcome him to the program. Glad that he took time out for us today to talk about the book and his career. Carmine, welcome to the program, sir. Good to have you on.
How you doing, Rick? How's it going?
Doing great, thanks. As I said, I was greatly entertained by this book. It was very interesting because we've sort of compared this in the past as far as approaches that people take when they write a book. Because we had on, at one point in time, two people who were very diametrically opposed in how they went about it, but it looked like they were going for the same principle, which is give the people what they want. We had on, at one point, Missy Hyatt, legendary pro wrestling manager, and she let it all hang loose in her memoirs the same way, talking about the wrestlers that she'd been with and all the sort of sordid stories that she knew people would want. A week apart from that, we had Bob Barker on, and his was very restrained, and he didn't settle scores and everything. But when you look at it, they were kind of both going the same way, right? Give the people what they want. Nobody wants to see Bob Barker throwing haymakers. But if you're Missy Hyatt, you want to get the raw stories from the road. And in your case, people want a lot of the same thing, and you really delivered for them in that way.
Well, I just wanted it to be a story that when people read it, they felt like they were there. And how it really was at the time, because it was really a unique time to be in the music business, you know, at that point in time from the late 60s onward, you know. And being able to live through it and survive through it was a pretty hard ordeal.
Well, it's an amazing story of, among other things, longevity, too, because just the list of bands and associations, where Vanilla Fudge, Cactus, Beck, Bogart, and Appice, or Rod Stewart, King Cobra, Blue Murder, some time out there with Ozzy, and you wrote about how dealing in the book about how dealing with Sharon was very interesting. So well before Sharon became a household name in this country, you were very familiar with her rough and ruthless side, huh?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And that's the not only me, my friend Bob Daisley, who was in the band with me, he's just suing her again. Read in Rolling Stone. He's suing them again because they control the publishing with all the songs. He wrote all those songs. Name any of Ozzy's big songs, he wrote them, you know, and they control the publishing. And apparently he's saying that he's getting screwed by them again. For, you know, again, it's in the seven figures, you know, seven figures we're talking about.
That's one of those things, though, and you certainly get a piece of that from reading your book, as is the case with many other things, but this sense of that a lot of times you get into a David and Goliath situation out there in the recording industry, and in this case you have the Osbournes who have consolidated all this power over a long period of time. You really get the sense from your book, as well as from other things that are out there, of how difficult it is to take somebody on when they get to that level of power.
Well, yeah, because it's all about, you know, that level of power is all about legal attorneys and everything, and who can afford the attorneys or not, you know, because attorneys aren't cheap. When I got fired off that tour, I had a contract, and I went after them. I blew $15,000 at the blink of an eye with attorneys, you know. Then I had to get an attorney that did it on a contingency because I couldn't afford those kind of numbers, you know. But they could, because, you know, they're out there making $100,000, $200,000 a night, you know?
These numbers definitely add up in a hurry when you're getting to that point. As far as any of the no-holds-barred stories from the book, have you gotten feedback from any of the people who've been written about in that way, whether it be the Osbournes
no.
or anybody else reaching
no,
out?
No,
nothing really,
no,
huh?
Nobody.
Okay.
No, nothing at all.
Interesting.
Yeah, matter of fact, some friends of mine just saw Jeff Beck, and he said to say hi, and he missed me. So, I mean, I still love Jeff as a person. I don't think Jeff handles his own business back then, especially.
Uh-huh.
And any deals that went down that affected us was, I don't think, were his doings, you know, where he said, let's do this to Carmine and Tim, or let's do this, you know. You know, I don't think it was up to him, you know.
Well, and it's, again, a very, very interesting business. It a lot of times changes people in different ways, and particularly when they get a taste of living this different life. But from my perspective anyways, the voice that comes across through the book seems to be kind of the same one throughout, seems to be an authentic kind of a voice. So would you agree with the notion that you really weren't, changed much by your experiences and really didn't become a different person or more consumed by the power and the money and that kind of stuff?
Well, I wasn't consumed by that. I mean, we were consumed more with the power of, went on with the groupie scene and all that stuff. But, you know, I mean, it was a different time, a different era. Everything was totally different then. You know, women were just coming out of their closet because they had, now you have birth control pills in those days, but before that they didn't. So they were, you know, sexually breaking out as well. So, you know, but I look back now and I think of the crazy stuff we did. I would never do that now. So definitely changed now for the better after going through all that stuff. You know, I have a daughter now, you know, I wouldn't want people doing what we did to the women back then, doing that to my daughter, you know?
Well, additionally, and I'm sure that this probably dawned on you a long time ago, as soon as the smartphones really started kind of popping up here, but what a different world it would have been, say, in the 70s with Led Zeppelin, if we were living in one of these cell phone worlds here where something ends up on the interwebs when that happens. Your life would have been completely different back then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, that back in those days, the only thing we had that was instant was the Polaroid camera, you know, but that's all it went to. It was a Polaroid camera, and it just went into somebody's collection, you know.
Right.
God knows where some of those pictures are now.
Well, yeah, exactly. Could be some of them out there still yet to surface or in somebody's photo albums. And, the ability to be blissfully kind of incommunicado also, too. You go out on the road there and you know, it worked both ways. You might have missed some people at home and, you know, wanted to, stay in touch with them a little bit better. But it was also great, I got to think, for lack of accountability as well. You know, you weren't having to play dumb on not being available. You just literally weren't available out on the road.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, the communication was just by telephone, you know. It was hard when you went to Europe in those days, you know. But the telephone was always a way to communicate, as we all figured
that's
out.
That's true.
But, you know, what's really funny is I have a guy who's I'm mentoring to do speaking gigs. You know, now that I'm, per se, an author, you know, we're putting together a program of life lessons learned from me, you know, Carmine Appice, after being in the business for 50 years. And he came up with all these really wild things about, you know, perseverance and the thing called the aha moment, you know, where you take an idea and you work it until you make it happen, you know, and character, because Rod Stewart was talking about character. He wrote the intro and he took all these subjects and helped me put together a really cool program to do, you know, corporate speaking, like motivational kind of stuff, you know, because, you know, let's face it, he's saying anybody that's been in an industry 50 years and still doing it, you know, it's got to be doing something right.
So, oh, absolutely,
so,
yeah. And,
So he took all the stuff from reading the book, beside all the crazy stuff, he took all the stories about, you know, coming up with ideas and doing it and pursuing it until it happens and, you know, not surviving, but more like persistence, you know, and learning
exactly
how to make a living in the music business versus just having hit records. So you can have hit records. A lot of guys have hit records, and 5 years later, they're out of the business, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Staying power is a very, very difficult thing in that business. And I don't know exactly how big. I don't think there's a huge space on the Venn diagram between drummers and authors, but we've managed to now have two of them on the show, Steve Smith being the other one. You, of course, are not new to being an author. I mean, new to putting your life story out there, but I guess this is the kind of thing you only get to do when you're at the highest levels of the business here. You know, the guy down at the bar is not getting any book deals, but if you're a super successful legendary drummer, you get a chance to do something like putting out the Realistic Rock Drum Method, which I think subsequently came out as the Ultimate Realistic Rock Drum Method. So that kind of caught my eye, and I want to ask you the same question that I asked Steve Smith about as far as this goes. Well, what are some of the more important principles to get across for somebody out there that's reading about stuff, learning about stuff, and incidentally, I have a nephew who is trying to learn drums. So what are some of the most important things that you try to get across to people when they want to be able to play the drums like you?
Well, you got to learn to, I think, learn how to play, you know, by going to a teacher, don't you? You know, you can learn yourself, but you go to a teacher, you learn a lot better. You learn how to read, which then the rest of your life, you could always improve yourself by getting books and stuff, you know. And then, you know, you have to have the passion for the instrument so you can practice. Without the passion, you don't really tend to want to practice. So you have to have the passion to do it, because it takes a lot of hours of practicing by yourself, trying this and you know, especially if you're taking lessons, you know, every week you go back and got to practice those lessons, go back and know them, you know, and you just got to commit yourself to doing it, you know, and it's not necessarily, you know, you got to try and get a place on your instrument where you can improvise and feel enough that you know enough about it and you know have enough knowledge to play where you can improvise and all that. And try and play different styles of music, you know. You know, when I grew up, I played everything. I played jazz, I played rock, I played, you know, weddings and bar mitzvahs and society gigs and jazz gigs. You know, and that's what gave me the ability to be able to play with all the different artists that I played with. Because, you know, playing with Vanilla Fudge and then playing with Blue Murder are two different animals, you know, playing with Pink Floyd and playing with King Cobra, you know, two different animals, you know, and it's just that kind of thing. But I played jazz gigs when I was a kid and all that. So it really prepared me for that. So I suggest that if they do all these things, they commit to the instrument and really, you know, and have the passion to practice and take lessons and go through it all, they could end up being a great drummer if they have the talent for being a drummer. Some people don't have the talent, and they, no matter what they do, they're just not going to end up a great drummer. Well, usually a teacher can tell that. And I had a school in New York for a couple of years, and I used to have guys come in, and some guys didn't have the talent, and I'd let them know. I'd say, look, as far as I'm concerned, you're just wasting your money here. I mean, we can go on and teach you, but you're wasting your money, because unless you just want to do it just for fun for you, fine. But if you really want to end up being, you know, a great drummer, it's not going to happen, because you just don't have the talent. You know, it's just like somebody trying to paint or be an artist. They have no artistic talent. No matter all the lessons in the world, it's not going to save them, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. It's got to be a combination of God-given ability and the work ethic to try to get the most out of it. But it's interesting you mentioned jazz drumming, because that's another question that I wanted to ask you, going back to, again, talking about the drummers at the very top echelon of the music industry over the last couple of decades. So I'm going to put another question to you that I put to Steve Smith when he was on, talking about Neil Peart and asking about that, you know, because that's something the rest of us kind of hadn't really thought about, is the kind of maladies that you guys will go through, the repetitive motions, whatever. In the case of Steve, he pointed out, I've predominantly done jazz drumming the last couple of decades. I've been lucky. My drumming hasn't had to be as athletic as Neil Peart's. You, on the other hand, with some of the metal bands that you've played with over a period of time, you know, you probably haven't been as fortunate in the sense that your style of drumming, I'm sure, has had to be a lot more energetic and a lot more athletic over a period of time just because of who you were playing with on many occasions. So what has that been like as you've grown older and as you're having to kind of deal with this and the way that your body responds, and hopefully not in as bad a way as it has happened with Neil Peart?
Well, I don't know what happened with Neil Peart, but I had two rotator cuff surgeries.
Okay.
So, and my right one hasn't healed up as good as the left, and it's not 100%, you know. So I sometimes feel it when I'm playing, which affects my playing, And, you know, I look back at some videos of me playing, like, in 1970 with Cactus, and I was a total animal, you know. I think Animal from the Muppets was based after me. That's what I was told. And, you know, I was a high-energy, amazing high-energy with my sticks really high, playing technical and hard, which I don't do that anymore, I guess because it's an age thing, you know. And I noticed, you know, I think some of my speed is starting to slow down. I mean, come on, I'm going to be 70 years old, you know. It doesn't last forever, you know. Buddy Rich died when he was 69, and he was still fast, but I don't know if he was as fast as he was, you know, 20 years before that, you know. And so it physically, definitely physically affects you. It comes from repetitive motion.
Well, this is just interesting for the public to know because, again, for those of us that don't know about the intricacies of this and how repetitive motion plays a part, that's pretty enlightening to hear about, albeit unfortunate when it happens to anybody. But when we're talking about this career and tracing back over a period of time and some of the different bands that you played with, and, again, you do get a sense in the book of some of the parts that you were more fond of, but just on a purely critical level, when you're looking back at your career, sort of putting on the music critic kind of lenses, what are the things that you're most proud of as far as your drumming performances and stretches of your career?
Well, probably the Ed Sullivan Show was one of them, Vanilla Fudge both times. And the fact that I created, or I'm known to have created, you know, these are other people telling me this, and I'm giving me, like, awards for it, like from Sabian Cymbals, that I created a style of rock drumming that's still going on today, which is the really power rock drumming where the drummers are playing hard, you know. So I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of my book, Realistic Rock, because it was the first rock drumming book by a rock drummer that has gone on to, you know, sell, you know, way over my wildest dreams. It's like 400,000 units with some major guys that have gone through it, like Dave Weckl and Greg Bissonette, and, you know, just tons and tons of people like that. And, you know, like Joey from Slipknot, and I just found out the drummer from Lit went through, and the drummer from the Goo Goo Dolls, and Andrew Dice Clay, you know, I mean, even Fred Astaire I gave a copy to, you know. And, you know, as you know from the book. And, you know, that's a great accomplishment that I'm proud of. And, you know, and pretty much, you know, writing a number one single and a top 10 single with Rod Stewart, you know. I'm pretty proud of that stuff, too.
But when we're talking about the totality of it and throwing the book into the mix also, too, this is another sort of recurring question that I like to ask guests who are in the music industry when they come on the show. And I think the first time I threw it out was to Christopher Cross, and the answer that he gave was very revealing, and that is the public is always fascinated by the notion of mailbox money. And I think Christopher Cross was the first to give the answer on this, and everybody else has kind of agreed with it, that basically it's not as much as what you'd think. And that has sort of been the consensus through a period of time. Is it generally inflated in the public sense when they're thinking, oh, these guys get royalties forever, and you can live off of this and that and whatever? Yeah. Is it that inflated in the public mind?
Yeah, totally, especially now, because now there's no record sales like there used to be, you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, when I wrote Do You Think I'm Sexy, and for years after that, I mean, we were getting royalties between ASCAP and the sales royalties. ASCAP is performance on the radio, which, you know, ran into six figures, you know. Now the sales part are lucky if they're in four figures, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's
you know,
point.
Right now a lot of us have sold the rights back to our songs back to whoever the administrator was because the 35-year copyright came back to us. And basically you have the right to keep it and get someone else to administrate or renegotiate the deal. In my case, I sold my shares back to my administrator to get a big payment over 3 years, you know, which for that payment, it would take me 30 years at the rate it was going to recoup, you know. So I was better off doing that, you know.
Yeah.
Because it really, all the sales are so down because of the Internet. The Internet's killing everything. Spotify, awful. Pandora, awful. You know, even my drum book is creamed by the Internet. Somebody scanned it, and they're offering it for free on the Internet, you know. And you can't keep up with these people, you know. So there's,
oh, yeah.
There's no copyright laws.
So much stuff that's out there on YouTube that you can pull up. So that's a good point. I can see where the economics of the music business kind of play a part in that way. Something I wanted to tell you about, and I want to circle back around in your book towards the latter part of the book, because I agree with some of the other critics that I've read that I thought that there was a lot of emotional resonance in that part there. But something I just wanted to tell you about, thought you might find this interesting, that a part of your career came up years ago on this show. I don't know that we would necessarily call it trivia about your career, but it more or less settled a contest that we had on the show. Long story short, we were doing a fantasy rock band draft. We were all drafting our version of whatever rock band. Had to be alive. That was the only thing. It was not including dead people. And the great session drummer, Pat Gesualdo, was our judge for the thing. So we had it all done up. Somebody took you to be their drummer. And the one rule of the draft was you could not also take somebody who had been in a band with somebody else, because it was the thought was, you know, we're trying to put together bands of people who've never played together. Well, the guy who took you didn't realize you had once played with John Lord. He got disqualified. That band would have won the contest, but they were disqualified because he didn't know enough about your career to avoid taking John Lord after he took you. So I thought you might get a kick out of that story.
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
So your name has long been mentioned on this show as far as your presence in rock history. And again, circling around, as I said, towards the latter part of the book here, when you're talking about the, I don't know if you'd call it a legacy of life on the road, but more or less coming to grips with, and the number that came to be 4,500 as far as the number of young ladies out there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How that came to be, because it was very, very interesting, and you mentioned, you know, subsequently your partner, Leslie Gold, a.k.a. the radio chick. Yeah, having you kind of break that down, putting together a spreadsheet, whatever.
You know, we just got, you know, how many years the first 10 years were, you know, and breaking it down.
It's a long spread, yeah.
How many would happen, like, per day, and how many gigs a year, and multiply that, and then multiply the next 10 years and the next 10 years, you know, until, you know, as the years went on, it got less and less because, you know, I was a little more mature, you know, but then it ended up with that number. It's an estimate. It's not a true actual number, but it's an estimate. You know, she used it on her radio show. That's why we did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an art, not a science, as far as trying to calculate that clearly. And, you know, the saying comes to mind, Carmine. They say when it comes to war, you know, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Is it the same kind of numbing kind of a thing here at, you know, where it starts to get to be a blur after a period of time?
Oh, it's a total blur, without a doubt.
Absolutely.
Sometimes I meet people on the road and say, do you remember me? No. then they remind me, you know.
That's being honest anyways. But as far as how that goes, I thought it was very interesting reading that part of the book, because obviously there's the part of, spoiler alert, everything works out with you and Ms. Gold in the end. But when you were talking about it, I thought it was very, very interesting. You're talking about your, I don't know if insecurities would be the right word, but what you were feeling, your trepidation, shall we say, as you're going through the process of trying to get the calculation here, to anybody that's reading the thing, all right, because sometimes there's a phenomenon of you can't see things other people can see. That it seemed in reading it, like, again, we know how the story turns out, but, I mean, if she was potentially that repulsed by what she was going to find out, it wouldn't have gotten to that point anyways, was my sense. So do you get the sense in looking back on it that your fears were kind of overblown and that it was probably already baked into the cake in her mind to whatever degree anyways?
What do you mean, that we were going to stay together? Or?
Well, yeah, that it wasn't going to be anything that was going to be that big of a deal, because she knew who you were. She had to know the number was probably pretty high. So is that one of those things, looking back on it, you think, gee, what was I kind of so worried about?
Well, I don't think we were worried about it. Let's put it this way. She won't read the book.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Because
she don't want
to. That's
fair enough. She don't really want to know. You know, she don't want to know details. She knows what you know, what that number, that estimate was, and don't want to know the details. And really, so basically, I guess that's how she looked at it too. She just said, all right, that was before, this is now. You know, I mean, as it reads out, you know, everything that happened with us was totally wrong for both of us. Like, you know, I never really liked light-haired blonde girls. light skinned, you know. I like more exotic looking women. And she's totally not that. She's a, you know, a Jewish girl from Connecticut, blonde hair, blue eyes, light skinned, you know. And I was a rock star who lived on the West Coast with kids who was older than her. That's three strikes against me, you know. But
absolutely.
On paper, if we were going to be on Harmony.com, it wouldn't have worked out, you know. But for some reason, it did work because, you know, we got along great. We never had fights. We had, you know, we both liked a lot of the same things. And she was a Harvard Business School graduate, and I'm a graduate of New York School, you know, of streets. And it's, you know, so it worked out 13 years later.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, these types of matters, of course, you know, much like the process of calculating groupies over a period of time, again, it's an inexact science, right? Relationships are an inexact science. Who's to say how these things are going to work out? And as far as her not reading the book, that's very interesting. And again, I think very understandable and relatable because absolutely no pun intended, but that saying about nobody wants to see how the sausage gets made, I can see how you might not want to deal with the entire history that somebody's had, picking it up and reading that. That's,
that's
fascinating.
My daughter I won't let her read it. I won't let my sister read it either. My son read it. He found it interesting.
You don't want to send anybody into therapy. That's probably a good thought. You know, that's probably for the best, but, you know, the book is obviously making a lot of waves out there. Of course, the book Stick It, My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. So you've got that going on. Obviously, you're still playing, still doing things musically. So as we circle around here, Carmine, what are some of the main takeaways that you'd like people to have? As well as go buy the book, what are some other things people should know about what you've got going on right now?
A new Cactus album coming out September 3rd, which will be out with a video, a brand new album. It's kicks butt. We're going on tour, doing 8 shows on the, you know, from Chicago. We're playing Chicago on the 24th. You're near Chicago, right? Where are you?
Yes, Cleveland. So, you know, a good drive.
Oh,
yeah,
Cleveland.
So.
Okay, so we're doing Chicago. We're doing Detroit. We're doing, you know, Pennsylvania, New York area. You know, that kind of stuff. We're doing 8 shows in that area, and to promote the album, and then. Got some more shows coming up with Vanilla Fudge. We're doing a Peace Brothers, which is me and my brother. We rebranded our Drum War show and calling it Peace Brothers. And we're doing like a Vegas Saturday, San Diego Sunday. And then in February, we got Australia coming up. And we got Vanilla Fudge shows coming up. I got a thing called the Platinum Rock All-Stars, which is playing at the Arcata Theater in Lake Charles on August 22nd. And, you know, we're just doing a lot of stuff. We're preparing a King Cobra Live. King Cobra Live.
Absolutely.
King Cobra Live at Sweden Rock Festival. And then we're doing a 50th anniversary of Vanilla Fudge audio and video live at the Sweden Rock Festival, plus some other tracks on there. That'll be out next year. And we're setting up next year, setting up some more shows in November. And, you know, just working away, you know, doing more installs for the book, doing more PR for the book. And so we've already been we're into our second printing of the book. So that's good. And that's
a great sign
it.
Of success there. Absolutely. And a very, very vigorous pace for somebody of any age. So hitting it as hard as ever with the schedule out there. I got to ask you a follow-up question. So what are the things you do? We talked about it before, compensating for age and some of the things that come into it. With this kind of a vigorous schedule, I mean, how do you keep yourself going out there on the road?
I've always ate good. I was never into the cocaine and the drugs and the alcohol. And I go to the gym 4 times a week, you know. So keep myself in shape, you know. I got my old age ailments, but I try to keep myself in shape.
Thank you so much for your time, Carmine. A real pleasure. Love to have you back sometime as your career progresses. It was a real pleasure.
Okay, and one other thing. If you go to my website, carmineapiece.com, as well as .net, when we send the books out, they come autographed.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right. Best way to get them, people. Go to the official website. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Carmine.
Thank you.
True pleasure. Bye. Thanks Bye-bye. For tuning in, everybody. FDH Lounge, mini episode number 743.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.